St. Pete Catalyst features St. Petersburg business and civic news, community-sourced insight from leading St. Pete business minds. Learn about startups, civic initiatives, and thought leaders at stpetecatalyst.com. Today, the world of journalism is facing rapid change. Florida Politics' Janelle Irwin Taylor joins Catalyst publisher Joe Hamilton in the studio to talk about the state of journalism, innovative digital media, and why newspapers of the future could operate more like museums. Taylor will share her varied experience in local journalism and the challenge of towing the line between journalism and editorialism, especially when politics are involved. Publisher Hamilton explains the why behind the Catalyst, his vision for solutions-focused reporting, and the necessity for critical thinking in readers and listeners. Listen now to this long-form conversation where Hamilton and Irwin Taylor will discuss bias, headlines, and journalism's role in silo busting.
Joining me in the Catalyst studio today is Janelle Irwin with Florida Politics. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought we'd have a chat about news because we're both in the news business and we're both sort of in newer modalities for news. And you have been interested in journalism your whole life. And so I'm sort of new to the game, but you've seen it go from where it was in the traditional days to where it's going now. So I'd love to kind of get your observations. Can we start with a little history of you in news?
Sure. So I got my start in this wonderful business all the way back in high school. I was on my high school newspaper, as many of us were. I was the jerk who outshone everyone just by, you know, brute and perseverance, which is why I say I was kind of annoying. I was like the teacher's pet. So by my sophomore year, I was an editor, and I really built something from that that's unique, I think, to most journalists in my situation. I probably shouldn't admit publicly, but I'm starting to be more open with this. I never finished my college degree. A lot of the older reporters are in that same boat, but people my age, that's unheard of. And I got pregnant with my oldest daughter when I was 17. So I was kind of just plugging away a class here, a class there. And in the process, I never let go of my dream. And I helped with neighborhood civic associations, create newsletters. I took on a lot of freelance work, doing coverage, hyper-local coverage for those newsletters, and built a resume from that. So I ended up getting hired in my first full-time paid gig before I ever even finished school. And now here I am 10 years later. And yeah, I've just never had the time to go back. So there I am. Where was I going with this? So yes, your question was, you know, about
when did service? Was the first full-time paid gig then the Business Journal?
No, that was, that's very recent. No, my first full-time paid gig was with WMNF Community Radio.
Okay.
I had volunteered for them for about 6 months when their staff reporter turned in her notice. And I applied for the job. It was like almost a year-long application process. It was absolutely ridiculous. I finally got hired, and I spent about 2 years there on staff and before I kind of left for greener pastures, for lack of better terms. But I have seen this business through the eyes of traditional media, you know, through the newsletters that I helped produce. Never worked for the Times, but in that regard, that was fairly traditional, to broadcast through the means of radio. And then working for the Business Journal, which was a paper, and then also for Florida Politics, which is a blog. So I've really kind of seen it from all angles. And it's fascinating to see the trajectory of where media is heading now, because you really are seeing a detraction from the Sunday paper and more to, you know, soundbite journalism. And I don't know if I love it or hate it, but I'm getting used to it.
So traditionally, soundbite journalism has gotten a bad rap because it's tied to clickbait and things like that. Does it feel like it might mature to a place where it's still soundbites, but it actually has some gravitas and some quality to it?
Well, I would argue that that already exists. For every clickbait that you see, here's how to get rich in 9 creative ways. For everything like that that you see, there are a dozen super serious journalistic reports, whether it's local, national, state, whether it's feature writing or hard news or politics, it's all over the place. And we do see the tweets and the Facebook posts and the Insta stories and all these new ways of getting information to consumers. But behind those are larger stories. And it's up to the consumer as to whether or not they just take the soundbite and leave it at that, or if they want to go deeper and read more into it. So I think it does exist. And I think my role, or at least what I'd like my role to be, is to have engaging enough content to make people really want to take that extra step and read that extra paragraph, get the little bit of extra information, and get us away from this environment of sharing based on headlines. I think that's the challenge.
And so what are your strategies for meeting that challenge?
Well, headlines are a huge challenge of mine. I am arguably not very good at them, and I strive every day to get better at them. But I think it's really important to have a headline that is not misleading. So often we see headlines that are sexy and we want to click on them, and then we read and we're like, that has nothing to do with anything that I just read. And then you're angry. And then when you make people angry, they're less likely to click on things later. So I think it's important to have those, you know, factual information-based headlines, but also in a way that is sexy. So how do you strike that balance? And I don't have an answer, but, you know, I think big dollar figures help. I think catchy quotes, you know, somebody saying something shocking certainly helps. But I think that's a big part of it, is having those catchy headlines. And in 2019, it's also about your social media engagement. You know, outside of the headline, what can you write that makes somebody scratch their head, that makes somebody intrigued? And that's another thing that I think is really challenging for reporters. And more we're seeing newsrooms, even as they're scaling back on their editorial staff, they're beefing up on social media staff, because it's so important to have the right messaging on social media in order to get those eyes on your content.
One of the strategies that we use is really focusing on people. A big portion of our content, I mean, you just came in to do an influencer profile. Even when we do hustles or when we talk about organizations, we always make sure that the people involved in those organizations are front and center. Because when you can put a human face to something, then it's not just some amorphous company that's easy to hate or easy to make generalizations about. You see that there are humans with theoretically good intentions, you know, running all this stuff and making this wheel go round. And so the more we can tie into the people, I think it sometimes takes away that little layer of anonymity that the, you know, the internet and generic, just using company names, puts forth.
Well, and I think that people are inherently voyeuristic, right? So when you do put the person into that, it's the same reason that TMZ is successful. We want to know, you know, what does Jeff Vinnick do when he's not making $100 million every time he sneezes? So I think that what you guys are doing is super important, and in many ways is very much the future of journalism, because it's sharing important information, but doing so in a way that people will actually want to read it. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to keep the consumer's attention. And I think that that's a fantastic strategy. You guys have the people-centric thing, and my publication, Florida Politics, is all about the politics. So we cater to a group of people, the political elite, I guess, if you will, who are just constantly hungry for more and more information about influence in Tallahassee, about influence in Tampa Bay, what's on the agenda at city council. I know Margie deals with a lot of this as well. And, you know, just really knowing your audience and tapping into those people, I think, is also very helpful.
And one of the rarity factors, especially in politics, is I think people are really hungry for interpretation. You know, financial matters or life event matters are sort of binary. They happen. There's not a lot of ways to take them. But political wranglings have a lot of nuances to them. Even though the vote may be yay or nay, there could be a lot of motivations behind who was for, who was against. There may be a lot of different layers wrapped into every piece of legislation. And, you know, that's, I think, from the very beginning, why Peter and you have been successful, is that you can bring new and worthy interpretation of events, which I think is unique to politics.
And welcome to the juxtaposition of everyday ecstasy paired with everyday nightmare. Because when you're talking about putting that analytical twist onto your reporting, you skate a very fine line of editorializing. And I would venture to say that there is not a day that goes by that I don't piss someone off because they think that I'm espousing my own political opinions. Newsflash to anyone out there listening, I do have my own opinions. And in some ways, I'm very transparent about them. If you've ever listened to my radio show, you know what I'm talking about. But I work super, super hard to keep that out of my reporting. And I am an equal opportunity offender. I will call out whoever it is for whatever it is if I see something that needs calling out. And it's really hard to skate that line. And I think it's really important for me as a reporter and not a columnist to make sure that when I am analyzing something and giving that insight that not everyone has, to make sure that all sides are represented. So getting that extra voice on the side to counter what, do you disagree with me? Do you agree with me? And that's how you kind of keep from crossing the very fine line.
Yeah, I think for us, that was one of those, sometimes ignorance is a great source of innovation. And because I really was ignorant as to the whole news world, you know, I had some strategies or philosophies or you know, sort of core tenets that I operated by in the executive world, which are, I think, you know, a lot of things go awry in the boardroom because of personalities and because of, you know, what I would call the inefficiencies of ego or insecurity or all those sort of things. And so what to me seemed like the path forward was, you know, sort of really strong transparency, really strong positive intention, and really strong logic. So logic-based, and make it about the idea, make it about the, you know, and be able to discuss it as objectively as you can without the, by stripping away as much of the personality out of it. And we sort of took that to what we wrote. And so I didn't classically understand what the whole line crossing was. I looked at us as a bunch of people trying to put solutions forward. And actually when Margie came in, she brought a lot of that because she's an expert at it. And so she's
a pro.
She instituted that, you know, really well. But I kind of thought it fit well with what we were doing already, which is, you know, to put forth earnest solutions and earnest, you know, show the intentions that we had for improving our community, which is a little bit different than reporting our community. So now we're sort of in between both. But you know, the example I like to give a lot is there's an article that comes out on how we don't have any talent here. And we know we don't have any talent, or, you know, I don't say we don't have any talent, but there's an article about our lack of talent, right?
Sure, sure.
And so we reapproached that issue and we did a 5-part series on how people are being, are creatively filling the talent void or filling the talent gap or whatever. And so instead of reporting on the problem, we came in with the solution or some just mirroring back what the community was already doing, not our solutions. And I think that's where, you know, we just sort of aren't a traditional news organization, but have found a way forward to have our work be generally absorbed on, across the spectrum without too much you're this or you're that, because we really aren't. We're just, you know, so heavily solutions-based.
Yeah, it's a lot more simple to do that when you're not throwing politics into the mix.
Yes.
When I was with the Business Journal, one of the things that I covered was the skills gap. And I was hired to take my expertise in political reporting and blend that with business reporting. It was not my forte, which is why I'm no longer with the Business Journal. I recognized very quickly that I was just not a good fit for that. So it was a great job. I worked with wonderful people. And it was a wonderful experience, but you know, after a couple of years, it was time to move on. But in that experience, I really looked at the skills gap, not just from, like you said, a creative way of solving a problem on the part of the job creators, or even necessarily through the higher learning institutions that create the talent pool, but from a policy perspective, bringing the political side into it. And something that could have been just super straightforward, as soon as you throw the policy into it, all of a sudden it's a debate and everyone has an opinion and you're stirring that controversy. So it's just, it's amazing that you can cover the same thing in multiple different ways and get an incredibly diverse reader reaction based on how you're telling that story. And that's one of the things that I love about journalism so much is because you just, you can report on the same thing 100 different ways.
And our mission is, I call it silo busting in a way.
I love that.
But to me, I think the only way you can do that, I don't think you can ever, you know, ideologically convince someone to leave your silo. I think you can make it uncool to be in a silo. I think you can make, you know, sort of that just standard top level rhetoric. I think you can make collective terminology uncool. You know, liberals do this, conservatives do this. Anytime you collectivize things, you should be seen as dumb, right? Because, I mean, obviously—
Your words, not mine.
Oh, I'm not, right? So, I mean, because it goes both ways. It's just, you know, it's just so easy to say all X do this and it's just not true. And so, you know, it's those things that when you're immediately fighting to hold those sort of optical positions that you don't ever get anything done. So if you make holding those optical positions uncool, and so, you know, we're launching a section called Community Voices. And again, a lot of what we built is take social media into account. So there's a reason why Facebook, you know, people give of their time and their content to Facebook, you know, by the millions of hours a day. It's, you know, it's because they get that value back and they're all heard. And it's a certain platform. And it's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily set you up for the silo busting. In fact, it's largely responsible for creating a lot of the silos, but we're trying to reverse that by, you know, building this platform where the Chamber and Preserve the Burg and the Downtown Partnership and Working Women of Tampa Bay and some of the folks that are coming on, some city council folks, you know, can put their thinking out there. But our challenge will be to not, you know, have these collective ideas of us and them or sides, and to really dig into the nuances of the issues, and specifically to say, you know, what's valued most on this platform is the people who can hold all the different perspectives in their head and in their content, and then come back with their thoughts on it, considering all of those at the same time. And I think if we hold that in the highest regard, that starts to move us in the right direction.
That sounds fantastic. This is not necessarily in my professional life, but in my personal life and the interactions that I have with people. One of the things that I try to do in terms of the silo busting is encourage people to read multiple sources. So if you're somebody who prefers MSNBC, go and see what Fox News is saying about the same thing and vice versa, because you really should have both perspectives. And the argument that I use to really try to make that sell is to say, keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer. If you feel strongly about XYZ, then you need to know what the enemies of XYZ are saying and how they're approaching this. And if you don't know that, how are you going to be an agent for change on this topic that you feel passionately about? You know, and then I'm also raising three little mini-me's, and I am very adamant with them that they not box themselves inside of these silos. We have amazing dinner table conversations about different sides of various different issues. And pretty much everyone in my household has the same ideologies as you would expect, I suppose. But I play devil's advocate an awful lot. And I challenge them to just think. Everybody needs to just think.
Yeah. And I think that's great, because sort of my variation on it is I think that truth is relative to perspective. And it's, you know, like one example I used in a conversation a little while ago was offshore drilling. And, you know, offshore drilling, the people who want it say that it creates an asset. It's a taxable asset. It's a business asset. And it, you know, depends on foreign oil and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And all that stuff is true. And environmentalists who say, no, it's a risk. It could hurt our tourism. It could hurt our environment. And that's true as well. And so I think you just end up in an infinite loop when you are trying to argue which perspective is true or not true without, you know, they're all true. And so then it becomes, again, that's where you can hold all those truths together and sort of put them out there and come up with the most creative solutions. But, you know, if we're all just stuck in defending the one particular perspective and the truth that comes out of it, then it's a really inefficient way to communicate.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about money and the journalism business. So,
oh God. Do I want to have this conversation?
I don't know. You know, obviously the Times is their money movements or whatever, the layoffs and their struggles are well documented, as are pretty much every large newspaper in the country. It seems like the exceptions are, you know, obviously the New York Times, even though they've had they're even reducing their office space and things like that. But the people who are coming in now, this seems to be the thing is that the really wealthy people are coming in and buying the news entities. I think Steve Jobs' wife bought The Atlantic. Of course, Bezos owns The Post. Somebody else bought The LA Times. And, you know, I've had a thought for a while that large journalistic entities will kind of go the way of museums in that, or orchestras, because they're things that bring a good to society. They have sort of a minimum critical mass they need to be useful. You know, an orchestra needs a hall, it needs 100 people who can be together and rehearse. The Dolly needs to be the Dolly to be the Dolly, and that's a large building in a prime spot. But there's almost zero of these types of things that can support themselves. They all rely on philanthropy. And so you look at journalism, and you know, it's something that I think it does need to have a critical mass. And that's what I think a lot of people, when we talk about modern journalism, forget is that some of the really big things that get uncovered, the really important things that get uncovered, can only happen when one, two, three, four people can just go off grid and research for a year and come back with these stories. And you have to have a certain amount of financial fortitude to do that, right? It's when you have to get two stories out a day or three or whatever it is, just to,
say,
pay the
two,
bills.
That's yeah. cute. Try four or five.
That's Sundays, right? You know, so I think there is a piece of reporting that needs to have that critical mass. And I, you know, already the Times is talking about, you know, they've kind of said in their arts reporting, they're going to go for grants. And they had a thing at Pointer the other day about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if all large news entities don't end up there if they don't get purchased by a Bezos type.
There's an interesting catch 22 when it comes to subsidizing media. On one hand, media as a private enterprise, you know, years ago, it was very profitable. I'll give an example of the 2012 Republican National Convention when that was here. It used to be that whatever the newspaper of record was where these large conventions were held, they would host the media kickoff party. But because papers were really struggling, all of a sudden it shifted. And you saw that the RNC here was actually sponsoring that kickoff. And that was just a really super tangible moment and really exemplifying how dire the situation was. So as a private enterprise, it's all about profit. And if you're talking about profit, you're seeing things like clickbait, things that are going to sell those ads and fund your enterprise. And that comes at a cost, the day-to-day editorial operations. And then you also have questions about influence in that process. Mm-hmm. You know, is there skewed reporting based on people who are helping to fund a newspaper survival? I mean, I think I can safely say that there have been a lot of people who have criticized the Tampa Bay Times for appearing to have some bias in their reporting on various different things. And now we have these funders coming in and basically bailing them out. And it's like, well, is this a pay for play scenario? Mm-hmm. So what's the answer to that? You know, do we look to public subsidies? But at what point does that become like state run media? You know, and that has its own inherent problems because then you're beholden to the state. And as we all know, that's the media is there to combat that, right? We're a check on that whole system. It's really sad to see, and we can blame consumers for not consuming enough. Mm-hmm. We can blame advertisers for being greedy. I mean, you can do any number of things, but I don't think that there's an easy solution. And it's just really sad because it is so important. And I'm troubled by the sentiments that we now see towards the media with the concept of fake news and constantly being derided by, you know, our own president of the United States for what we do. And, you know, it's really sad. It makes me really sad.
I hear you. And so it's tricky, again, coming in from an outsider's standpoint. You know, I think newspapers have always sold ads. Newspapers have always probably, you know, relied on some pretty large advertisers as their core revenue. And so that sort of pressure is always there.
Yeah.
And then there was this line of keeping the, you know, that separated from the journalist. But, you know, whether it's sort of the tail wagging the dog or not, I don't know that many people comfortably say that there is objective journalism. You name any major news outlet and you say it, and you, whether it's burned into you or whether it's just through propaganda or it's real, the net result is kind of the same, is that you think it leans one way. So if I say Fox News, everybody thinks it leans one way. If I say New York Times, so everybody thinks it leans one way, you know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I don't know whether it's possible to put that genie back in the bottle or not, where anybody will think anything's objective anymore. Unless, you know, I think that almost circles back to the silo busting. You have to have the people who make objectivity has to, you know, play a more central role than any specific point of view. And I think the place you find that is when the people who aren't necessarily financially attached. So I would say, you know, even for us personally, you know, the Catalyst needs to break even, but my other endeavors, you know, have me covered. So don't feel that pressure, you know, which actually gives me an advantage. And I would say that Bezos did not buy the Post to make money. I don't know that Steve Jobs' wife needed the money, you know, to buy the Atlantic. So
I would think not.
Yeah. So, you know, there are people coming into the fray that are, and again, you're always, is that ever truly clean? Are you ever not going to, you know, do something if you own it and you can?
Well, and I don't care how much money you have, but if you're willing to put your money into a sinking ship without any hope of financial reward for that, do you think for a second that there's not, you know, a vendetta there? I don't think anybody's ever going to buy that. I'm not sure we should put the genie in the bottle. I think that's a wasted effort. It's not going to happen. Everyone comes to the table with their own implicit bias. And it is more about getting your news from multiple sources so that you can weigh multiple different perspectives. I think it's helpful to have those different perspectives. And it makes for a more entertaining read when you're reading something that has that passion behind it. So, you know, don't say, oh, you're left-leaning and therefore we can't trust you. Say, well, that's an interesting perspective. Let's see what the other side has to say. And then you have the whole spectrum of views for which to form an educated opinion. So I don't think that necessarily we need to put the genie back in the bottle. We just need to somehow change reading behaviors.
Push the responsibility for that objectivity.
But then good luck with that.
To the reader.
Yeah, how are we going to do that?
Yeah, I believe it can happen. At least not across the board, but I believe there's a middle 80% that could probably get there.
What do you think social media's role? Now I'm asking you questions. I just put my reporter hat on apparently. Like Facebook, for example, there's so much criticism out there about to what extent should platforms like Facebook sort of censor their content? You know, should they be removing things that are blatantly falsehoods and things like that? How much responsibility do you think is on those types of companies to really kind of make sure that you're not controlling the dialogue,
right,
but you're at least making sure that it's not riddled with falsehoods?
I think that you can't speak in absolutes when it comes to it. It's sort of like, you know, when does art become pornographic, right? It's just a line that it exists somewhere, right? And, you know, you can't say, you know, if you're true free speech, anything goes. But if you are, you know, utilitarian for society, then it's, you know, what's your basis to juxtapose that off of? But I think first, you know, I believe in gathering data, and I don't think that people really understand how easy to manipulate and how, you know, we are the sum of our inputs. And you see it time and time again where people can say, you know, Will Smith puts a song out and says, do this, and millions of people do that. And in the science behind that, it went from the old days where you knew that if you, you know, made your logo red, it would make people hungry and they would want to eat more, to, you know, the absolute, you know, manipulation of people has become, you know, a really largely mastered science. And so I just don't think it's an example of where society as a whole hasn't caught up with the evolution of technology and thinking. And so I don't think that a lot of people's critical analysis skills can keep up with the ability to manipulate them. And so if you start from that standpoint, then, and you have enough actual evidence of that happening and disinformation happening and, you know, the new fake videos that are going around and things like that, that I think that before anybody starts arguing back and forth, I think getting that information out so people truly understand how pervasive and effective the manipulation is, I think that's a great way to start that conversation.
Sure.
And I go back to, you know, I think it's going to be it has to start from the consumer, because it's just, you know, in government, the minute they change a law, there's 64 people, you know, they put a new tax rule out, 6,000 people out there finding the loopholes and finding the way to work around it to achieve the same thing. And it's this infinite cat and mouse game of trying to plug the loopholes and finding the loopholes and, you know, then throwing all the, you know, the other reasons why legislation gets passed. And I think that the place I would start first is in at the consumer level and, you know, educating people on how they're being influenced and educate people on critical thinking skills. And to your point, checking different sources and all those sorts of things. So yes, I think there's a responsibility. I think, you know, instead of arguing forever about what to censor, what not to censor, I'd almost say, yeah, have that conversation. Certainly don't not have it, but put a lot of resources into educating people on how they receive information, how to think critically.
We talk so much about civics education in public schools. It's lacking, right? It's 7th grade. I think that's all they get. I think also that there should be maybe not a dedicated class or curriculum to address this, but I think that our educators should be part of their training, should be in teaching their students to be smart consumers of information, And I know that that's part of it. My husband is a teacher, and I know that he's, you know, cautions his students about the things that they read. And part of his, he teaches history. Part of it is, you know, what's a credible source for sure. But on a day-to-day basis, how much are we really teaching our young students how to question what they're reading and really evaluate whether or not it's fact or bullcrap? I think, and I would like to see that be more of an emphasis in especially public schools. Can't tell private schools what to do, but sure. you can for public schools. And I would be totally on board for that.
Yeah, that's an ideal, you know, then you just always run into that resource problem. You know, yeah. Kyle Taylor from the Penny Hoarder was in, and he's pushing a similar type of, effort for financial literacy because yeah. you know, people just don't understand how much their credit card interest is costing them. And it's, and they don't understand student debt, and they don't understand, you know, savings and taking care of themselves in the future. And along those lines, the same thing is true with health, right? Because people don't understand the true costs of their diet and how to be healthy. And, you know, the whole world is set up against that. So yeah, it's a tough nut because the complexity from which with the people who are experts of things, you know, there are people that spend their whole life studying and digging into the most nuanced things, you know, trading in anti-anxiety medications, or I always said in the previous interview, left-handed butterflies, right? The people spend their whole life studying that, right? And then
do butterflies have hands?
They don't have hands. So that was a joke I had in a podcast with Nathan Schwagler. But the point was that the expertise is so deep, you know. And kind of wrapping that back in, there's a great book called The Rise of Superman that Stephen Kotler put about flow and just how fast we've accelerated. I don't know the exact numbers, but he studied extreme sports, and you know, for like 20, 30, 40 years of competitive snowboarding, no one had ever done, I think it was a 780 twists, like 2.5 turns or something. And then somebody did it and they figured it out. And you know, it's still humans trying to do this twist, right? But just being able to hack their brains and hack their style, this thing that nobody had done for 40 years in the sport. Now it's, you know, not a standard trick, but everybody does it as part of their normal thing. And you just sort of hit this ramp of evolution and understanding these things. And it's just happening across the board. And we're just not even close for our infrastructure to handle that.
Yeah, I agree. I want to go find a left-handed butterfly now. Yeah,
good. Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. I think it's one we could have for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think we covered some good ground and enjoying the work at Florida Politics. Peter's come in and he's doing a podcast here. He said, she said.
Oh, is he doing that here?
Yep.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah, we like having him stop in every day. And he hosted our last Tiger Bay event. So he's been love that he's back and active in St. Pete. And thanks for all your good work.
Next time you see him, tell him I could use some reinforcements.
Okay.
I think he's working on it though, so.
Cool. All right. Anybody wants to write for Florida Politics? Reach out.
Don't do that. You'll get me in trouble.
And reinforcements. All right. Thanks.
A thanks to Joe Hamilton, publisher of St. Pete Catalyst, and from Florida Politics, Janelle Irwin Taylor. To read and hear more, visit stpetecatalyst.com.